Good morning. It's me. Can you hear me?
You're listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Kalan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on and then you tune in and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more, and more, and more, and more.
St. Paul on the Aguarico. The claws were starting to emerge. It's a couple hours after dawn, and the narrator has moved to San Pablo, a small village of indigenous Siacopai or Sequoia people in the Ecuadorian rainforest to teach English, 1997. I'm in Rolando Lusitande's hut with him, Soraida, his wife, Marcial, one of their two sons, Marcial's wife, whose name I don't know, a gaggle of grandkids, a desperate-looking adolescent black woolly monkey tethered to a floorboard in the kitchen area, a little green parrot perched on a basket hand-woven of split vines, and a long-haired gray cat that hisses and runs away when I try to pet it. Rolando has three brothers and two sisters. The family isn't Sequoia by birth, but half Siona, half Cofan. Rolando is one of the village's experts at maintaining and repairing outboard motors. He's a blend of confidence and humility, prone to broad grins, one of those who have mastered the art of living and don't need to flaunt it. Plump and smiling, his wife, Soraida, is the daughter of Francisco, the old shaman chief, and his wife, Alicia, and the sister of Jeronimo, the silent shaman I drank with in September last year. Soraida fed me owl yuca flatbread with venison from a deer that Marcial shot yesterday, plus a gourdful of delicious plantain chicha. Soraida's mother, Doña Alicia, is here too, smiling with her crinkly face. She lives in a tiny satellite hut connected by a catwalk to this one. Some tourists just walked through the village. I peered out at them through a crack in the wall as they photographed the hut, unaware that an outsider was inside, spoiling the authenticity of their photos. Joaquin asked me not to talk about Yahe here because of the political problems around it, but Rolando brought up the subject with me. He confided that when the missionaries came in, he was studying to be a shaman, and under their influence, he stopped, right as he was starting to learn to transform himself physically into a jaguar. The claws were starting to emerge, he said. Not at the fingertips, as I expected, but at the knuckles where the fingers met the hands. Tienen que salir de aquí, he explained. They have to come out from here. It sounded crazy. Where do the fingers go then? I wondered. They turn into pads? When I had a jaguar trance, my fingernails wanted to rake the floorboards. Was I doing it wrong? Two of Rolando's grandsons, Apollo and Lenin, practiced their five or six English words with me. Tall and light-skinned, with a commanding air, Apollo is Marcial's son. He says, good morning, forcibly and clearly, as if it were a challenge. Young, dark, and cerebral, Lenin is the son of Rolando's other son, Raul, the director of the school I'll be teaching at. Lenin focuses on nouns he can visualize. Fork, spoon, house, cup. On the platform where dishes are washed, the tethered monkey creaks and squeaks and chatters, hungry. He just ate a ripe plantain, but Rolando says he wants meat, which he's not allowed to have. The cat is afraid of me and hides under a bench. I'm sitting on the best hammock while a second shift has lunch to my right. Gnats harass my fingers and ankles. The monkey fellates himself. Three-meter lengths of PVC tubing and a four-foot fluorescent light tube look incongruous, stuck up in the palm fronds of the roof. What's up with that light? I ask. It was floating down the river one day, Rolando says, and I pulled it out and brought it home. Maybe one day the village will have electricity and you can use it. That's what I was thinking, says Rolando. By the way, your friend Marco is back at Joaquin's place. I ran into him on the river yesterday. From your country, Marco brought a good quality double-barreled shotgun for Joaquin. That's great, right? Yeah, a shotgun? How did he bring it on the plane? He told me he took it apart and carried it in his luggage, just like that. But why didn't they stop him? Maybe he used magic, Rolando grins. Rolando's son, Marcial, tall, athletic, in his early 30s, is fanning the fire that smokes his venison with one of those black wild turkey feather fans. He's heading to Quito for a few days to talk with a tour company he works for sometimes. Though it's the dry season, a light, brisk rain has just begun to fall with the sun shining down. I'm not sure which kids belong to which parents. Digna, a bulky little tank of a girl, whops a littler girl over the head with the feather fan, causing the littler girl to burst into tears. Soraida, the girl's grandma, takes the fan and whops Digna over the head with it, causing her to burst into tears. Another little girl was already in tears from an unrelated incident and was in Soraida's arms already. So Soraida gathers the two newly crying children to herself and tries to soothe them while Rolando grins and whops himself over the head with the fan in a vain attempt to prove that it doesn't hurt. Everyone over six is laughing at this point. Later, Digna wants to go after another girl. Rolando has some nettles he's been whacking his back and his hand with. As previously noted in these writings, nettles are used as therapy for sore muscles. Rolando takes the nettles from where they're rested against the wall and interposes them between the two girls, making it impossible for Digna to proceed. After I've hung out for a while, Marcial and Rolando take me to the lodgings to which I have been assigned, a six-year-old dilapidated hut belonging in absentia to an Argentinian anthropologist, Maria Calvino, who lives and works in Germany, where she is married to a German entomologist. I napped in the dilapidated hut until 10, when it got too hot to sleep. In my dream, I'm on a talk show in the USA with some Wiccans discussing paganism. Afterwards, a tall, young Christian guy approaches me, furious, wanting to yell at me, afraid he's going to punch me. I say, hold on. Whatever we set up there doesn't change the fact that Jesus died on the cross to save you from eternal damnation. And never forget that he did that. Never forget. I'm in the hut now, seated on a rough wooden chair at a rough wooden table. Sweat is pouring off me. Thunder is rumbling in the distance. It's 3:28 p.m. Two chickens are hunting for insects in the middle of the soccer field. Marcial and Rolando are bringing me a stove and a gas tank. Such is the life of a teacher. Wet morning in dilapidated hut. White chicken dashes across soccer field in rain. Rumbles of thunder and flashes of lightning and far out clouds at midnight led to a rainstorm at dawn. In my dream, I'm a famous film director. and milk-skinned, blue-eyed Noni of the bat skull pendant is my star. We're at a round table under a parasol at a posh outdoor cafe on the Côte d'Azur. With a knife and fork, I'm eating the skin off her left forearm, which is covered with hot, sweet mole, chocolate chili sauce. This act symbolizes our devotion to art. It doesn't hurt her, and we laugh and chat delightedly.
One,
You're listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Kalan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, and then you tune in and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more, and more, and more, and more.
First steps around San Pablo. It's January, a third of a degree below the equator, and the narrator, a gringo who wants to be a shaman, has just moved into a dilapidated hut in the Sequoia village of San Pablo de Cantasia on the Agua Rico River, where he will begin to teach English at the junior high school. Lots of curious kids hung out here yesterday, rummaging through my belongings, observing me, and giving me huge quantities of tree grapes. I was making a bead bracelet, and the kids asked if they could have some fishing line and beads too. Sure. Most of them soon got bored and left, but one, nicknamed Dardo, Dart, stayed and finished an orange necklace for his mom. He went home and gave it to her. She sent him back with a necklace for me of smooth gray seeds, Job's tears, strung on chambira palm fiber. Dardo asked about life in the USA. What animals do you hunt? What crops do you farm? Do you have a truck? It makes sense from the point of view of the Sequoias that the kids went through all the things I brought here. If a stranger shows up in your village, you want to know what he has in his bags. I wonder if their parents encouraged them to do this to sweeten the deal they threw in the tree grapes. Perfect. Rolando Lusitande's two older brothers visited my hut. The first, Sebastian, immediately told me he had been studying to be a shaman, as the practice was being eliminated by the missionaries. Sebastian wears a blue tunic and misses drinking yahe. He's Joaquin's age, but skinnier, resembling a jocular Julius Caesar. His eyes look in different directions. The oldest Lusitande brother ambled over a few minutes later and introduced himself as Enrique. I've been told he's called Dede, which is the onomatopoeic name of one of the frogs around here. He does have a wide mouth. He didn't say much, just sat drinking an instant coffee I gave him, looking goofy and peaceful. San Pablo was calm at 3:58 p.m. I scratched the archipelago of mosquito bites on my legs. There's a faint smell of smoke from a cooking fire. Symbolizing my troubles, gnats pester my head. Symbolizing my heart, a woodpecker drums on a tree across the river, pounding and pounding to find the nourishment it needs to survive. I sauntered over to the Sunday service at the church this morning, thinking, God is God. It doesn't matter where you worship. Half my family is sort of Christian anyway. Plus, it's insanely boring in the village on Sunday mornings. Wouldn't be my first time in an evangelical service. There was that time up in San Luis Potosí, Mexico, with the Juan Ohioan, the friendly gringo missionary who looked like me but with curly hair, the dissolute alcoholics, and the adorable women with the delicious pork and mole sauce and fresh corn tortillas. In this unadorned rectangular building, Serafin's younger brother Domingo Piawaje preached in Paincoca. Then the youngest brother Dagoberto played guitar while the congregation sang. I was struck by how cacophonous this music sounded after yahe songs. Domingo spoke again in Painkuka, Dagoberta whispered to me, "He says Yahweh is the serpent in the Garden of Eden." I nodded. One night on Yahweh, I'd concluded that the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil was a psychedelic, and that the snake, in encouraging Eve to eat it, was setting humanity on its path. Domingo preached on. Dagoberto leaned over and whispered, "He says if you have the name of Jesus on your lips, you can never go wrong." What about the Spanish Inquisition, I thought, and the conquest of Mexico and Peru and the Crusades? But as a visitor, a guest, I kept silent. Afterwards, I talked with four barefoot, round-faced Zaftig women in brightly colored blouses and skirts, and a barefoot, eyebrow-less, dapper man in his fourth decade, wearing a white robe and a simple wooden hoop for a crown. I couldn't tell if he was married to one of the women or not. His septum was pierced, though there was nothing in it. I thought, now or never. "Would you please pierce my nose here in the middle? I want a hole in it like you have." There was some discussion. Then, "No problem. Wait at your hut. We'll be there." A couple minutes later, he and the women came into my hut. He'd broken a spine off the trunk of the palm tree. Now he wiped it on the sides of his nose to pick up oil to make it go in smoothly. Seating me on my chair, he leaned down and smoothly ran the spine through the thin membrane with a small pop. The pain made one tear roll out of each of my eyes and down my cheeks, producing two tiny fisheye lens reflections of the smiling women, the dapper man, and the jungle behind them. I wiped off the tears. The serious, dapper, eyebrowless man broke off each side of the spine so just enough of it was stuck in there. He instructed me, put in a bigger spine in a couple of weeks. And then a couple of weeks later, another one. That should be enough. He and the smiling Zaftig women left the hut in a blur of color, whereupon I lay back in my green cotton hammock and contemplated the throbbing in my nose and the ache of the wound pressing against the spine when my heart beat. At dusk, on the way to the river to bathe, I had been instructed to use soap to clean the nose. I ran into Manuel Paiwahe. He and his dad, Jeronimo, were at the first ceremony in the provisional lodge last September, the one where Ryder was a werewolf and I a horsefly restaurant. Clumsily, I made small talk. "Do you drink with your dad a lot? Why are you studying shamanism?" "You probably didn't feel safe talking about it here in San Pablo," I thought later. His tight-mouthed answer, "A shaman is respected like a doctor." Or shot and killed like a wild animal, I thought. I taught at the Colegio Rio Aguarico for the first time today. A good time was had by all. The school is housed in two buildings built of wood and roofed with zinc sheeting. I have two classes, each an hour and 20 minutes long, with a 10-minute break between them. All the students are from here except four Quechua kids from downriver who live in a small dormitory. The director is Rolando Lusitande's son, Raul. Placid, heavy, rooted, he's more a deep thinker than a fast one. Because the Sequoia community here is formed by the union of two clans, the Piowajes and the Paiowajes, with a few people from other groups mixed in, the school kids are named things like Elizabeth Paiowaje Piowaje, Miguel Piowaje Paiowaje, and Andres Piowaje Piowaje, with the occasional Beatriz Paiowaje Lusitande. My colleagues are Edison, Sequoia Mathematics, Norisa, Quechua Literacy, Mercedes, Quechua Agriculture, Paco, Quechua History and Social Studies, and Alberto, Quechua Science. Another good day teaching. In the absence of books, the material comes out of my head. I write it down on the board, and the kids copy it onto their notebooks. Raul, the headmaster, and Alvaro, the head of the Sequoia organization, have asked me to teach a small group of adults tomorrow after my classes at the school. Forget this. I'm getting out of here. It seems a shame to deny the kids their educational experience. Why don't the community leaders just sell some of their land and buy an English teacher? Value, one zinc roof. The most annoying thing is not having a social life in close proximity to those who have vibrant and loud ones. After the classes, which last until noon, I sit here at this table in the hut all day killing time. The men leave early in the morning to hunt or work in gardens far away from the village center. As I mentioned yesterday, the authorities asked me to teach English to some adults, but no one showed up. Yesterday and today went better. It helps to vent sometimes on paper and in the company of others. As luck would have it, I received yucca, sympathy, and a fish. As a fabulously wealthy outsider, I'm not expected to have any needs. But when I shared my feelings with Raul and then Alvaro, they saw me as a human, a pint. After my first week of teaching, school is out for a two-week break. I'm heading out of the forest to Quito, but first, I'm waiting for a canoe that can take me downriver to visit Don Joaquin and his family at Cabaña Supernatura again. Sitting on an empty gasoline barrel atop the low bluff where San Pablo meets the river, I'm looking forward to seeing Jim Timothy, with whom Joaquin and I drank yahe last weekend. I'll tell him about teaching and about the dream I had last night, about getting chased around a spiral Stonehenge by a dwarf witch who likes dreams. I caught a canoe down here to Supernatura. Jim had left during the week. Don Joaquin taught me to work on a hammock he's weaving on a loom. Two vertical wooden poles lashed to a roof beam in the middle of the hut. I sent the heavy, long wooden shuttle through the links at the bottom edge of the webbing and doubled back again and again. Made a mistake and thought it wouldn't matter, but Joaquin, the perfectionist, said, and had me unweave a few lines and fix it. After dinner, his son Rufino and I talked about bringing more tourists in. It's January 29th, my 29th birthday. I spent a couple of hours working on the hammock, imagining myself 5 decades from now weaving another hammock on a spaceship. At midday, Washington Piahuahe's dad, Timoteo, dropped by with a pair of Ecuadorian oil company managers and a fast aluminum motorboat. They wanted to ask Rufino about running a jungle tour. Mistake there. But he happened to be out with his wife visiting her parents on the other side of the river. Grinning at me, Timoteo seemed half Mongol, half wildcat. This guy is studying to be a chaman, he snickered to the oilmen. They snickered too. He turned to me, eyes narrow, lips taut, teeth showing. If you want to be a good healer, Tuanque, that's all right. But if you end up a witch, we'll burn you alive. That's fine, I nodded, thinking, but how will you be sure if I'm a witch or not?
Good morning. It's me. Can you hear me?
You're listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Kalan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on and then tune in and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more, and more, and more.
Hold on tight. Part 1. Hold on tight, this is a revolution. Back in Quito, everyone was mad at the president for being corrupt. I got an earful about the guy, Abdallah Bucaram, nicknamed El Loco, a roly-poly populist, the spitting image of Oliver Hardy right down to the Hitler mustache on the center of his winningly smiling upper lip. Last August, Bucaram held his inauguration party at the Hotel Quito, which is perched on the eastern edge of the city and has a commanding view of the neighborhood of Guapolo, where I live when I'm in Quito, as well as of the Machangara River Valley, the eucalyptus-forested hill on the other side, the towns of Cumbaya and Tumbaco, and on a clear day, the snow-capped volcano Mount Cayambe, 75 kilometers due east, which, among its many virtues, has never hosted a president's inauguration party. In all fairness, there may have been a buzz of madness in the thin air that night from some weed Mauro and Rumi were smoking, huddled like sailors around the fireplace on the balcony of the Café Labirinto, 200 meters down the hillside from the Hotel Quito. The party guests drank like fish and fucked like rabbits, then drank like rabbits and fucked like fish, and finally frank like fabbits and ducked like rish in a kind of metamorphic sexual apocalypse. In the morning, hotel staff found bras and panties dangling from potted plants. Once the hangovers wore off, President Bucaram appointed his 18-year-old son, Jacobito, to be the nationwide head of customs. Some months later, rumor had it, the president threw another party. His clever son had earned his first $1 million. And last month, the price of gasoline tripled, which may help explain why Washington Piahuaje's dad, Timoteo, didn't burn me to death straight away on suspicion of being a witch. Finally, a 3-day general strike was declared. I use the passive voice because the strike seemed to arise of its own accord, directly from the people, as if a flock of pigeons had suddenly decided en masse to pivot in the air. In Guapolo, on the evening of February 5, 1997, Che and Rumi and Mauro and some other people and I were in the Café Laberinto, when a guy came in and yelled, "Everybody's kicking out the president. He's blockaded himself in the presidential palace on Independence Square. Let's roll." 9 of us were present, including the newcomer. Unfortunately, Rumi's red 1967 Ford Taurus, Elvis, was up on a set of wooden blocks awaiting repair. There was barely space for 6 to cram inside the guy's black 1995 Jeep Cherokee. So, 3 of us young men stood on the back bumper and clung to a centimeter-high metal rim on top of the vehicle. Having ridden this way in the desert in Mexico, where there hadn't been anything at all to cling to, I felt like a pro. The driver gunned it, and we surged up the steep road. At the first switchback, all 3 of us fell off. The driver stopped, and we climbed back on. We readjusted our hand positions, swore, and funneled all our energy into clinging to the Jeep like ticks to the ass of a water buffalo as the metal beast charged up the hill. When we reached the highway, the Jeep sped toward the old city, where the poor live among Spanish colonial churches and 300-year-old government buildings. Terrified of a pothole or even a bump in the road, we bumper riders zoomed along the dark highway, streetlights streaking by like comets. Guy in the middle yelled to me, "Tell him to slow down." I leaned way up and yelled in the driver's window, "Slow down." Driver hollered back, "Hold on tight, this is a revolution." I reported, "He says, hold on tight, this is a revolution." Guy in the middle yelled, "Fuck!" We clung. The driver knew this section of the highway like the crack of his own ass. It was new and perfectly smooth. The highway, I mean. All at once, he turned into an off-ramp, decelerated, and found a parking space. The old city was thronged with people in a festive, revolutionary mood. But for me, pumped up on adrenaline after the ride, the scene was anticlimactic. I'd just survived a brush with death. I'd lost that zen focus of fingers gripping metal. Crammed into Independence Square were tens of thousands of people jumping up and down and chanting rough gems of folk poetry, like, get him out, and kill the bastard, Separated from my friends, meandering through the revolution, I yawned. Inside Carondelet Palace, we learned a few days later, the president and his aides were looting their own offices, stealing whatever was valuable and not nailed down. At 3 a.m., they would be airlifted by helicopter to the coastal city of Guayaquil. But now, at midnight, the palace was surrounded by a double row of riot policemen. Wearing black armor and grimaces, they had been standing for hours with nightsticks, plexiglass shields, and full bladders. "Nothing's happening," I said to the ones in front of me. "If you want, we can replace you, and you guys can go home and relax." The private looked even more uncomfortable than before, but the sergeant cracked up. At 1 a.m., I hiked back to Guapolo with a Colombian journalist who was staying at the Laberinto. Among the many things he told me, one stuck with me. "In my country," he said, "if you see 2 people making love in the forest, you should leap over them and shout your name, and if they conceive a baby, they have to name it after you." In the morning, the country had three presidents. Bukaram refused to resign and made defiant speeches from the balcony of his home in Guayaquil. His vice president, Rosalía Arteaga, claimed that the Constitution held that if the president were removed, the vice president automatically replaced him. And the head of Congress, Fabián Alarcón, declared Bukaram mentally incompetent and himself president. When the dust settled, Alarcón was in office. 2. Hold on tight, this is a jungle tour. I made handbills for a jungle tour and passed them out on the sidewalk in the tourist district. 17 hours of that over 2 days yielded only one tourist, but she was a good one. A cute blonde from England with a nose ring. She walked back to Guapolo with me and we ate bowls of chili at the Café Laberinto, talking jungle and gazing east off the balcony at the aforementioned snow-capped Mount Cayambe, 75 kilometers away, the last high peak before the descent to the forest. With her chubby cheeks and pouty lips and wide innocent blue eyes, Judy looked like a forest sprite from the Moomin books. Che came along on the tour to cook again, this time without Christine, as the two of them had split up. The other guests were Norm and Alex, who had connected with me through mutual acquaintances. Norm was a Boston school teacher full of intellect and laughter, a kind of capuchin monkey in human form. Alex was a veterinarian from New Zealand with long, curly black hair shaved on the sides above the ears. Perhaps, he speculated, he was nothing more than the thought projection of a monk meditating in a cave in Bhutan. He had just been in the jungle drinking ayahuasca with Dave Sternstein's old teacher, Ignacio Chimbo. He said that at one point deep in the ceremony, he and Ignacio somehow ended up crawling across the floor arm in arm, following some logic that made sense to the two of them at that moment. "Just a couple of jungle bunnies," Alex grinned, reminding me suddenly of someone else that I couldn't figure out who. The first day of our tour was catastrophic. On the way from Lago Agrio to Chiritza, our pickup truck taxi stopped because two trucks had just collided head-on at a bridge. A man walking toward us, blood pouring down his head, said, "Free my buddy, he's still trapped." Their truck was fucked. The buddy was pinned by the steering wheel behind the glassless space where the windshield had been. Five men, including me, started uselessly pulling on the metal with pickaxes. The guy pleaded with us to hurry up. The driver of the other truck came over and accused him of causing the accident. The two of them argued about whose fault it had been until I cut them off, pointing out that this was a bad time to get into it. Thanks to a fantastic stroke of luck, the other truck, which was hardly scratched, had a winch on it, and its driver turned the truck around and got the winch into action. The hook pulled the dashboard off the legs of the pinned driver. His right foot was twisted as if collaged on crudely. It hung floppily when they carried him out. He was crying a little. They carried him to where his friend was lying by the side of the road. No one wanted to turn around and take the bleeding men back to Lago to the hospital. A brief argument flared up among the drivers of several vehicles until someone agreed to do it. A card with an image of the Virgin Mary had fallen beneath the grill of the smashed truck amid the shattered glass. A teenager picked it up, looked at it, and flicked it back in the dirt. 5 minutes after getting going again, our taxi smacked and killed a white chicken that was, for some reason, crossing the road. The driver stopped. A guy named Milton, riding with us, who cooks for Tortuga Tours, sprang out, scooped up the dead bird, and brought it along as we zoomed to Chiritza. There, my partner, Rufino, was waiting at the river's edge with gassed-up dugout motor canoe, sunglasses, and toothy smile. He nodded as we told our story, listened carefully, got all our gear on board, and set off with us down the rippling mirror of river. When we finally reached Cabaña Supernatura and brought up all our gear and supplies, Che, acting in his capacity as expedition cook, sprang into action, rolling a joint and smoking the whole thing by himself while reclining in a hammock, and we all went down and washed the dust and the bad feeling off in the river. The next morning, Rufino hiked with us 2 hours in the forest to Cocaya, where we had gone with my first group of tourists, the place named River of Voices, after the conversations of the ghosts that some Sionas had heard here 90 years ago, after fleeing to escape slavers during the rubber boom. There was a lean-to of branches and leaves, and under it the remains of a campfire. This time, unlike the first time, Che had brought enough food for us to Cocaya, and we met animals. Even before meeting the animals, in fact, we met a voice. Walking in the forest, we heard a roar start up not far away, rising and falling, ongoing, not pausing for breath. The veterinarian from New Zealand glanced at his watch. Led by Rufino, over the next few minutes we homed in on the roar to find a father, mother, and child howler monkey up in a tree. The father was teaching his child to sing, Rufino said. Rufino explained that, like dusty titi monkeys, howlers sing on the inhale as well as on the exhale. When it was over, Alex looked at his watch again and noted the roar had gone on for 43 minutes. Using as bait a chonta palm fruit mash that Rufino had brought, we went fishing. I caught my first piranha, the first of a dozen piranhas we would catch that day. Alex hooked a stingray, brown and creepy looking, and pulled it up on the narrow beach. Rufino prodded it with his machete to demonstrate how the tail would swipe upwards with the sting erect. Then he slashed with the machete to cut the line and let the animal swim away. This was a busy day in the stream. Norm got a bite, and soon another ugly face snarled at us from the brown water. Rufino said, "It's an electric eel. Don't reel it in." Rufino cut the fishing line and let it go. I walked upstream and found two otters watching me from the water. They held my gaze until I called to the others to come and look. Then they ducked underwater and vanished. I yelled, "Never mind, they're gone." Like the hunting spider that had crawled on my chest hair in 1995 before the ceremony with Dave, these wild animals were happy to encounter me as fellow beings, but not to be objectified. As we were enjoying the dinner of rice and piranha that Che had cooked in the fireplace in the lean-to, Rufino remarked, "My mom wants me to decide if I'm a Christian or a traditionalist. I'm the pastor of the village of Sieco Ya, but our old traditions make a lot of sense to me, too. My mom is a Christian, and my dad is a shaman. My mom says, 'Rufino, you're 38 years old. It's time to choose a religion.' 'We all think you should be a shaman,' Judy asserted." "Can't you be both?" I asked. "Up in Mexico, this tribe I stayed with, called the Coras, is all Christian and shamanic. The shamans have to go to the church and pray to Jesus for the power to heal people." I wished I could teleport him to the village of El Nopal for a talk with Don Tritemio, the Cora shaman I stayed with there. "No, I need to choose. It's one or the other." The issue couldn't be resolved, so we left it for another day. After philosophizing, we bedded down. With a piece of tape, Rufino had patched the hole in my tent. With no mosquitoes jaguaring my blood this time, I dream I'm in the basement of the Reform Synagogue my dad attends in Ann Arbor. Two old gray-bearded Jewish guys in long black coats wordlessly bring me down a narrow corridor into a crammed library room and show me shelves of huge leather-bound books containing dream records of the Neolithic ancestors of the Hebrew people from long before the days of Abraham and the revelation of monotheism. One of the men takes down a book, puts it on a table, and opens it to an illustration like a cave painting. It shows a series of initiates entering the mouth of a great bear, making the passage from youth to adulthood by allowing themselves to be symbolically killed and resurrected. A gnarled hand turns vellum pages. The next illustration is like a three-dimensional film. A young man has been tied up in a tree, his arms extending up along two of its limbs, his head resting on his right shoulder. He's dying of thirst. He volunteered to sacrifice himself so the spirit powers of the world might have pity and send rain to end the drought that threatens to wipe out his tribe. He has always loved trees, and now he uses one to communicate with the sky, his thoughts ramifying out through its branches, calling to the rain, "Please come, please come." After he dies, clouds form and spill abundant rain, as if the sky itself is weeping for him. I look up from the rainstorm on the page to the two old men who are staring at me, making sure I understand. There's a thunderclap and a shift in levels of reality. I woke up in the jungle. Outside, a storm was raging. We had neglected to put up tarps before going to bed. We had been enjoying the food and conversation too much for that. My tent was soaked. I was sure everyone else's was too. Water ran in streams on either side of the foam mat I was sleeping on. I dipped my toes in the water to gauge it, and then, with my feet, folded the mostly dry blanket around my feet. In their own tents, Norm, Alex, Judy, Che, and Rufino were in the same bucket, I thought, in the same boat, in the same wet blanket. There was nothing any of us could do. I saw Abdallah Bukaram's face, then the face of the Virgin Mary lying in the shattered glass on the road in the dark and the rain. I saw the faces of the two injured men, the first with what looked like two black ropes of blood, one running down either side of his face. I saw my companions' faces as they lay nearby. Norm, the handsome, skinny, early 50s Boston schoolteacher, prone to bursting out in dazzling simian smiles, now somber and quiet, listening, remembering the monsoon of India, and waiting for the very first siftings of the deepest blue of dawn into the dark of Kokaya, river of voices. Alex, the Kiwi veterinarian, the jungle bunny who, with his broad grin, squinty eyes, and black poodle curls, looked and even moved like another Alex I had known. Alex, my friend, the Greenpeace canvasser in Seattle, who once got me stoned and put on Bob Marley, and who later died of a heroin overdose. But the two Alexes didn't think alike. Their minds were wholly different, though they could have been brothers. Judy, the chubby-cheeked, upturned-nosed, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, North European forest sprite, lying in the dark, listening to the thunder and to the stirrings of electricity in her own limbs, the ghosts of Kokaya whispering to them in an unknown tongue, like Hattie Fatteners. She had dreamt of these ghosts all night, though she wouldn't remember most of the dreams. "We think you should be a shaman," she had told Rufino, and with these words, she drew the ghosts of Kokaya and knew they were people she could work and play with. Che's long, narrow face pressed against a folded blanket. I imagined his dark brow furrowing in the dark as he thought in the tent in the rain about the accident with the trucks, and how to get a fire lit for coffee and oatmeal in the fireplace under the lean-to, and when the next time was that he could drink a beer. And Rufino, my business partner, the son of my shaman teacher, a short, energetic man with a big nose and a small chin and black hair usually tied back in a ponytail, except in the evenings by kerosene lamplight, when he would unbind it and stride around organizing, preparing, laughing with his wife and four kids and two parents with their two different religions. There's a whoop the Sequoias give off when they laugh hard with delight, and Rufino is a master at it. Though right now he wasn't whooping, but lying in the dark, listening to the sound of the rain, sifting his memories, dreams, and reflections. There must have been men like him in pre-contact times, I thought, and my academic side began to chatter anthropologically. I wish I could travel back and see how the Sequoias lived then, how similar or different were Stone Age people around the world. Did my people think like Sequoias? I saw the faces of the two old men in my dream. What else is in those books, gentlemen? I thought. Crack them open again. Show me Proto-Hebraic flood stories. Teach me our hunting magic. Lightning flashed like a firefly, and thunder cracked, and the rain redoubled its fury, to the sound of the hoofbeats of the rain on the tent. I rode off into unconsciousness again.
1, 2, 3, 4, good morning. It's me. Can you hear me?
You're listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Kalan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on and then tune in and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more, and more, and more, and more, and more.
Dad Dreams, in memory of Frederick Albert Horowitz, 1938 to 2013. I'm sad. The battery has died and the watch my dad left me. Ever practical. My wife says, just put it in a new battery, and hands me a tiny screwdriver. I unscrew the metal plate from the back of the watch and inside find a somewhat larger box, like a metal matchbox. I extract that and unscrew its metal plate. Inside is a tiny bundle of papers. I unfold them. They're 8 poster-sized colored pencil artworks that my dad made in the early 1980s in perfect condition, unwrinkled. Each image is built around a core of notes he jotted during a trip to New York City, actions he wanted to take, moments he wanted to remember. The colored pencil work surrounds and incorporates these notes. One image is a tableau of 6 strangers standing side by side on a subway platform. The strangers are stylized, each a different color, smooth as chess pieces. Their faces halfway between human and animal, depicting some animal-like quirk of personality. Second person from the right is a gray rat woman, glossy and clever. There's a smidgen of reality connected with this that I've had multiple dreams about discovering art that my dad has left for me, and weirdly and inexplicably, in June of this year, my mom discovered 7 photo albums of my dad's from the mid 1960s to the early 1970s in a corner of her basement that he's never been in, and she didn't put them there, and I didn't put them there, and nobody put them there, so they just freaking materialized there, including photographs of the place that my dad lived in 64 to 66, which is 10 blocks from where I am right now. My dad is preparing for departure. A couple times I realize he's dead. He's quite upbeat. We're in his apartment with a few other people. He mentions that I have an identical twin brother who was taken away and given to another family to raise, and who's living somewhere else. I say, well, give me his contact info, for God's sake. But my dad just smiles and shakes his head. When he's gone, I notice how clean the place is. He left nothing but a pair of his brown shoes.
which, when I look at them, turn into a pair of brown baby shoes. I realized after I woke up that the twin he was talking about was him. I'm in a building in Vienna, Austria. Outside, rain is beginning to fall. Through the open window to the courtyard, I can hear my father's voice. He's rhapsodizing about how good the rain feels falling on his head. I lean out the window to say, "You put a hat on right now, young man," but the courtyard is empty. I'm on a ferry, but I'm going through some old empty notebooks to donate them. One proves to be not so empty after all, but it's actually an old sketchbook of my dad's. The sketches are wonderful, including architectural details of 19th century houses, color studies, and a simple pen and ink drawing of a huge cruise ship in dry dock, dwarfing two figures who stand next to it in conversation. Passenger next to me is a tall Brit, about 60, wearing a trench coat. He asks to see the sketchbook, then pockets it and refuses to give it back. I yell at him and shake him, but he acts like he doesn't know what I'm talking about. The ferry's heading into port. I'll yell for security guards or police to help me. He won't get away, or maybe he will. As I'm waking up, I think he's oblivion. Just kind of think about what happens to people after they die, like bits of them vanish, you know, mixed into the, put back into the mix. My dad shows me a metal box he's prepared to leave for me. Inside is another copy of his will, a small plastic bag with coins in it, another with some bills and an old book. This had been published by my dad's teacher, Josef Albers, in 1888, the year Albers was born. The spine had cracked and disintegrated. The pages were discolored on one edge. The text was words that transformed Escher-like as they went across the page into multicolored pictographs and geometrical designs, a perfect blend or middle mixture of literature and visual art. Next one, I look for my dad where he's living now. I've been there before, upstairs in a big old house he shares with others. I see two housemates, a man and a teenager. I'm the outsider here and need to explain to the boy that I'm going to visit my dad. The boy says, "You've been here before, right?" So, okay, I go upstairs. My dad stands naked in his room, looking the age I am now. He's confident, but melancholy about his possible role in what went wrong between us. I say, "No, look," and hand him one of my molars, which recently fell out. A blue rot has tunneled through it. Problems that I used to blame him for were caused by a medical condition on my side. I'm sitting at a table with my mom. A cat is on the table. As a joke, I turn on my digital sound recorder, hold it out to the cat, and say something. The cat says, "Hi, Fred." They drive away. It's very late, but there's still a lot I want to do tonight before going to bed. I go into the car. In the dark, I rummage through the shopping bags, but can't locate the textbooks I'll be teaching out of. I give up and shut the door. Maybe I should just go to bed. I've been out of town traveling for a week, and the thought of my disheveled but peaceful bed is suddenly comforting. But where's my apartment? Missing my dad, I walk along the street. The city's a blend of Vienna and Ann Arbor with a dash of Arkansas. I think I live somewhere near the tall apartment building. I pass another apartment building that brings back memories for my youth. I remember the Bulgarian hooker scolding Renton and Sick Boy in Trainspotting 2 for living in the past. I think of my friend's son, Solomon, and how humanity replaces itself, and how he will be as good a man as my father was. Where is my home? I wander along as I walk along. Where's my bed? In the crossroads, 20 feet from the last house my folks and I lived together before they split up in 73. So sitting in a crossroads between right near the house that my folks and I lived together before they split up in 73. I'm sitting at a card table trying to daven, which is Hebrew for pray, trying to daven with three other men. A man on my right is a cipher. I never look at him directly. The one across from me is my dad, pumping out ancient syllables like a heart. The one on my left is related to my dad, but not to me. Clean-shaven, like him, younger, thin-faced, serious, with a downturned mouth, one of those who direct themselves inward toward the tradition rather than outward as I do. Ashamed I don't know Hebrew, I grasp at words I don't understand. I want to sink into the earth. That does the trick. Memorized long ago, the words come out in a rush as if from underground. Mi molel guvrot Yisrael otan mi yimne en mechador yakum hagibor ha'el ha'am. Who can retell the things that befell us? Who can count them? In every age, a hero or sage came to our aid.
1, 2, 3, 4, You're listening to Nighttime Daydreams with DJ Kalan K on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on and then you tune in and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.
Will, am I recording? Thank you.
Sometimes you're part of a project is to work on it like a slave.